Support for KQED comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com. The Commonwealth Club radio program comes on again tomorrow morning at 1. News from the BBC is just ahead. Are you curious about the histories and mysteries of Bay Area cuisine? KQED knows all things food, from recipes to guides on the buzziest bites in the Bay. Visit explore.kqed.org to explore all things Bay Area food. We had slightly cooler temperatures today. Expect a further cool down into the weekend. The National Weather Service says another warming trend is on track for early next week. I'm Michelle Hennigan, and this is KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highland Sacramento at 11 p.m.
Hello and welcome to Newsday here on the BBC World Service with James Copnell and Victoria Uwonghunda. Great to have you with us.
In Sudan, the UN says that 35 children were among those killed in an attack on a village to the south of the capital. Throughout Sudan, people are struggling to stay alive as the war continues. Aid agencies warn we could see one of the biggest famines in decades. We'll speak to the regional director for the World Food Programme.
Also coming up this half hour, Ireland heads to the polls to vote in continent-wide elections for the European Parliament. So what do the Irish voters want?
And researchers in the UK have developed a new method for predicting dementia up to a decade in advance. We'll speak to the leading scientist on the report.
A full bulletin of sport as well as business, but all that after the latest world news.
Hello, I'm Chris Barrow with the BBC News. President Zelensky of Ukraine will visit French arms manufacturers today as he seeks to rally European support against Russia's invasion. From Paris, here's Andrew Harding.
President Emmanuel Macron has become Ukraine's loudest cheerleader, refusing to rule out sending French troops and warning Europe that it needs to do far more to contain Russian aggression. President Volodymyr Zelensky's appearance here in Paris on the eve of European parliamentary elections looks like something of a personal thank you note. President Macron's political opponents certainly believe the Ukrainian visit, complete with a speech in Parliament and meetings with arms manufacturers, has been timed to bolster the French leader and his struggling centrist party.
Donald Trump has made his first campaign appearance since his New York hush money trial, apparently uncowed by his unprecedented conviction. Addressing supporters in the key swing state of Arizona, Mr. Trump railed against the judge in the case and repeated his attacks against President Biden on immigration. Union members among workers at Samsung in South Korea are out on strike, the first ever at the giant technology company. The walkout mostly involves office staff at Samsung's headquarters. Here's our Asia business correspondent, Nick Marsh.
The main union wants bigger pay rises, it wants bonuses to be paid, it wants an extra day of annual leave. They haven't been able to come to an agreement with the bosses at Samsung Electronics, so they have told their members, 28,000 of them, to not quite go on strike, but actually to take a day of paid leave. Today is a Friday after a national holiday, so it's a day when a lot of people would take leave anyway, but the idea is disrupt operations as much as they can while not fully going on strike.
Several Sri Lankan Tamil asylum seekers who've been transferred by Britain to Rwanda have told the BBC they've been left stranded there and are afraid. They were among 60 Tamils fleeing persecution on a fishing boat that landed on the British Indian Ocean territory of Diego Garcia. Four of the group spoke to Alice Cuddy.
Dozens of Sri Lankan Tamils landed on Diego Garcia in October 2021. Some were then transferred to Rwanda for medical care after attempting suicide. They've been granted international protection and are waiting while a third country is identified to permanently settle them in. But the group say they feel isolated and afraid in Kigali and that their complex medical needs are not being met. One described their experience as like living in an open-air prison. A top Rwandan official said the migrants' concerns about personal safety were not shared by others.
Alice Cuddy with that report. This is Chris Barrow with the latest world news from the BBC. Three football spectators in Hong Kong have been arrested on suspicion of insulting the Chinese national anthem after they remained seated as it was being played in the stadium. The two men and one woman had been attending the city's World Cup qualifier match against Iran. Police said they'd also turned their backs. A UN agency says the high number of young people killed in a massacre in central Sudan on Wednesday showed how children were paying the price for the country's civil war. UNICEF said 35 children were among the more than 150 reported victims in Wad al-Nura, which was attacked by the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. The group claims it was only targeting an army post. Netflix says it intends to vigorously defend itself against a defamation lawsuit filed by a woman claiming to be the inspiration for the delusional and abusive stalker character in its hit series Baby Reindeer. The lawsuit says the show's claim it's a true story is the biggest lie in television history. Will Vernon reports.
The series portrays a violent stalker called Martha, who's eventually jailed for harassing the film's protagonist. But Fiona Harvey, who's widely believed to be the inspiration behind Martha, denies stalking. She's filed a lawsuit in California, accusing Netflix of telling brutal lies about her to 50 million people worldwide. Her lawyer, Richard Roth, told the BBC he has incontrovertible documentary evidence that his client was never convicted of a crime in the UK.
The plaintiff is seeking $170 million in damages. A survey in Japan suggests people of working age are getting more sleep than 25 years ago. The number of those surveyed who slept fewer than 5 hours a night stood at 11%, compared to more than 20% in 1999. Government guidelines have been urging people to get more shut-eye. That's the latest world news from the BBC.
Thank you for that news. Hello there and welcome to News Day here on the BBC World Service with James Copnell and Victoria Wohunda. Coming up shortly, we hear stark warnings about the humanitarian crisis in Sudan as the war between the army and the rebels rages on. We've been getting many messages on this from so many of you, and if you too want to share your thoughts, send your comments to our usual number on WhatsApp and text +44 77 86 20 5085. We also have stories from Ireland, and we hear why one woman is suing the streaming giant and Netflix, plus the latest sport news too.
We start with a desperate situation faced by so many in Sudan as the war between the Sudanese military and the paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, continues. As we've been hearing all this week, people all around the country are struggling to get enough to eat to survive. Experts have told us that as many as 4 million people could die from famine. On Thursday, the World Food Programme announced an urgent expansion of its emergency food and nutrition assistance to the country. Michael Dunford is the WFP's Regional Director for Eastern Africa. He told me first what additional measures have been announced.
The World Food Programme is attempting to now reach over 5 million people. And that's because the situation, as you've been reporting, continues to deteriorate because of the conflict and because the World Food Programme and other humanitarian actors have struggled to be able to expand our operations. We are simply not reaching all of the people who need support, and that's why there's this continued effort to do everything we can to ensure we are feeding the people who need it most.
How do you then scale up across the country, given some of the constraints, the areas you simply can't access because they're too dangerous or you'll refuse permission from military leaders?
It's extraordinarily difficult. We are continuing to negotiate with all of the authorities and all of the additional militia groups. I was told yesterday that, in fact, there are now, in addition to the SAF and the RSF, over 40 militia groups that are active in Sudan at the moment.
As we've been hearing, things are definitely getting worse. More and more people on the verge of dying, simply people dying because of a lack of food. Have you seen any change in the willingness of armed groups to let food into their area as they see civilians in their areas in this dire situation?
We have seen of recent times some improvement from the government authorities to facilitate support, but it's happening erratically. And what we really need at this point is is to have consistent access and approvals from the government, and that the RSF and others allow humanitarian actors across the country to scale their operations.
Which are the parts of Sudan that you are most concerned about?
So these are the areas predominantly held by the RSF, so Darfur, the Kordofans. You know that there's an ongoing siege in El Fasher. We know that people are being displaced as a result of that, many crossing over into Chad. These are the areas that it is particularly difficult. We're trying to bring food across from Chad into the Darfurs, but there is currently permission only to cross at a border crossing called Tine. What we need now is permission from the government to access additional corridors so that we can really scale the operation. This is the biggest challenge. To prevent the risk of a famine perpetuating, what we need is to be able to operate almost at industrial levels, distributing food across the country. Without that, as you suggest, we will see increased levels of hunger, malnutrition, and tragically, deaths as well.
That point about needing government permission to come into Darfur, it's almost surreal, isn't it? Because the government doesn't really control much territory in Darfur, certainly not the border points. And yet, somehow you are held up by a refusal from a power that has no real military say over that area.
This is the complexity of the environment in which we're operating. Obviously, the authorities in Port Sudan are still the sovereign controllers of the country. We need to respect that, and as a result, we need to continue to press them to give us full access throughout the country, certainly.
You've talked in broad terms about your concerns that things could get worse. How bad are we talking if aid can't be scaled up to the required amount?
Well, what we already have is very high levels of hunger. We saw that in the recent data that has been collected. We will get specifics on the scale of that in the coming days and weeks. Beyond that, we've got massive levels of displacement. And then finally, we're seeing increased outbreaks of disease and sickness. So when you have hunger, displacement, and disease, that is unfortunately the perfect recipe for a famine. So even if we don't have it declared next week, that is the trajectory that Sudan is moving along. And if it's not a case of if, but when all of the necessary indicators are met.
And that means hundreds of thousands, probably millions of deaths.
Tragically, yes. We will see a very significant uptick in the number of people who are dying as a result of hunger, unless the World Food Programme and others are able to scale. And that will only happen with an end to the conflict and to have the levels of access that are required. And importantly, we also need from the international community the funding to be able to do the operation that is required.
Michael Dunford from the World Food Programme. He's their regional director for Eastern Africa. He talked about funding. A reminder that the UN's work in Sudan and aid agencies is terribly underfunded. Pledges simply haven't been made to the required amount. We've had a message in from someone who doesn't give a name but simply says, it is so sad the world is watching a senseless war claiming innocent lives in Sudan.
It's 13 minutes past 7 o'clock in London and Dublin, where voting has opened in the European elections for 14 MEPs, members of European Parliament. Immigration has recently become a strong political issue in the Republic of Ireland, and far-right activists have been organising protests about the rise in immigration over recent months. The elections for the European Parliament have been happening this week and will conclude this Sunday across European Union Britain's 27 member states. One big change that polls are indicating in the run-up to the elections is a rise in support for populist right-wing parties in countries like France, Italy and a few others. However, polls are indicating that this may not be the case for Ireland, and the big winners could turn out to be independent candidates. Well, let's discuss all of this with Bridget Lafan, who is the Emeritus Professor at the European University Institute based in the Irish capital, Dublin. Good morning to you and welcome to the program. Let's start with immigration. Why has it become such a strong political and sometimes divisive topic in Ireland?
The surprise in Ireland is that although the population changed dramatically over the last 20 years, immigration was not a conflictual or divisive issue in politics at all until the last 6 months. And I think perhaps it's because of increase in numbers, but also there is an acute housing crisis in Ireland. The population is growing. There's a shortage both of rental accommodation and houses to purchase. So there are pinch points that raise the that have allowed the right to mobilise on this issue.
So what other issues are you seeing in Ireland? Because earlier we heard from young people across Europe who said that they feel like they cannot trust NATO, the military alliance. They feel like they want a stronger Europe and that their leaders from the traditional parties have not been listening to them. Is that the same kind of mood in Ireland, or are you seeing other issues that are people concerned with?
Well, the European elections in Ireland are, in a sense, a prelude to the national election, which will happen within the next 8 months. So the focus in Ireland is less on European-wide issues and more on domestic issues. But on the question of defence and security, Ireland geographically is pretty distant from places of trouble. And so the society doesn't have a strong sense of insecurity at this stage. So I think the continent is different in that regard.
And in terms of when we're looking at Ukraine, with President Zelensky now on his way to France, or he is in France and he's going to be speaking in front of the French Parliament and seeking more support, I wonder how do the Irish people view the war in Ukraine and what kind of support have they been showing?
So Ireland has has one of the highest per capita concentrations of Ukrainians since the war began. So there's been, the society has been very open to helping Ukrainians. The government supports and funds non-military support for Ukraine. So I would say there's a very strong consensus in Ireland, apart from the very, very far left, to support Ukraine. But of course, we're not militarily strong, and we're also a neutral country, so we're not giving Ukraine armaments.
So Bridget, having studied Europe and continuously looking at what is happening onto the continent, what could we be expecting to see? Well, some of the results will be coming out today in some countries, but come Sunday when all the elections are concluded.
Well, what people will watch very carefully is how the different party groupings in the European Parliament perform, because that will determine who will be the next president of the Commission. The president of the Commission must be ratified by the European Parliament. So people will look very carefully at the big groupings, how strong they are after this. And then, because no one party or even two parties can dominate the Parliament, people will look very carefully at where a majority will come from. And then the second issue that will be looked at very carefully will be what happens on the right, because there is a lot of movement in, there are two, there's a far right and an even harder right in the European Parliament, and there could well be movement between them. And I think that will determine a lot of the kind of European Parliament we have. So the real politics starts once the elections are over the summer, then looking at the party groupings in the parliament and where majorities will come from.
Bridget Lafande, who is the Emeritus Professor at the European University Institute in Ireland.
This is Newsday on the BBC World Service with Vic and James. Here are some of our main headlines. France is rolling out the red carpet for Ukraine's President Zelensky as he seeks more weapons for his country's fight against the Russian invaders. Donald Trump has made his first campaign appearance since his fraud conviction, attacking both the case against him and President Biden. The South Korean tech giant Samsung has been hit by its first ever strike, as we've been hearing on the programme, although it insists disruption is being kept to a minimum. Now let's get the sports with Isaac Fanning.
Big day at the French Open tennis. We're in the final stages of the tournament. On Monday, Jannik Sinner will become world number one for the first time. He's hoping to win his second major of the year, though. Before that, he's got to get past second seed Carlos Alcaraz, then the runner-up for the past two tournaments. Casper Ruud takes on Alexander Zverev. On Saturday, we're going to see Iga Swiatek look to win a fourth women's French Open title. She plays the 12th seed Jasmine Paolini in the final. In basketball, the Boston Celtics were dominant in game one of the NBA finals as they beat the Dallas Mavericks 107-89. A team performance from the Celtics, all five starters scoring double figures. Jaylen Brown top scoring with 22. And we saw arguably the biggest upset in cricket history as the USA beat Pakistan at the T20 World Cup in a super over, basically extra time for those of you who are unfamiliar. They both had 159 runs after 20 overs. The US then scored a 19 in their extra over and Pakistan were unable to beat it. An incredible victory for the USA, which cricket is not their sport, and yet here they are beating Pakistan, one of the biggest cricket nations on planet Earth. Incredible.
Astonishing stuff, Isaac. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, time for business news now. Streaming giant Netflix is facing a multi-million dollar lawsuit from the woman who allegedly inspired the character Martha in the hit drama Baby Reindeer. Our business correspondent in Singapore, Nick Marsh. Nick, you have been following this incredible story for us. Please do tell us. It's been in the headlines, this show. It's been a hit across the world. But first, tell us about this lawsuit. What's going on?
Yeah, it really is incredible. You've watched this series, haven't you, Vic?
I have indeed. Seven episodes, I believe there were.
Yeah, I mean, it really is quite something. You race through it. It's such an incredible story. For those who haven't seen it, it's a series written by starring Richard Gadd, who's a British comedian. It tells the tale of his alleged experience of being stalked by a woman he meets working in a pub in London. And in the series, that woman is a character called Martha. Now, I won't go into everything, but the character he's stalked by does some pretty bad stuff in the show.
You don't want to spoil for those who haven't watched it, like James next to me here.
Yes, well, exactly. I won't spoil it. You know, some of the stuff that she does is bad, and it's criminal stuff, you know. And viewers, after the show ended, very quickly pointed the finger at someone called Fiona Harvey, who's a woman from Scotland, and they said that's the real-life person who stalked Richard Gadd in real life. Now, Fiona Harvey denies stalking Richard Gadd, and she's suing Netflix in a $170 million lawsuit, which has been filed in a California court, and it basically says, I didn't do the things that the series says I did, and above all, I'm not a convicted criminal, which is what the Martha character ends up being depicted as having been. Worth bearing in mind, she's not suing Richard Gadd, she's suing Netflix for not having checked any of the details with her before putting the show out and therefore, allegedly, defaming her.
So with that then, how has Netflix responded?
They haven't responded so far. The BBC's put in a request that we haven't had anything yet. It's interesting because if you've watched the series, you'll know it starts with, this is a true story, which is quite unusual because normally it's based on a true story, inspired by a true story, something like that. But at the end credits, they do say it's based on real events, but certain characters, names, incidents, locations, and dialogue have been fictionalized for dramatic purposes. And we see this in TV shows for this precise kind of legal reasons. We don't know exactly what Netflix's defense is going to be, but the chief executive of Netflix was speaking to the UK Culture, Media and Sport Committee last month, and he said, look, this is obviously the true story of this horrific abuse that Richard Gadd suffered at the hands of a convicted stalker. Now, this conviction is probably going to be the central tenet of this lawsuit. Fiona Harvey says she wasn't convicted of anything. The Martha character was. We're going to have to see how this plays out. But my God, it's got people talking, hasn't it?
It has. I mean, if there's one thing that we know that Baby Reindeer will do is get people talking. Nick Marsh in Singapore at our business desk.
Scientists here in the UK have developed a new method for predicting dementia almost a decade before the disease starts. The World Health Organization says dementia is something that affects 55 million people worldwide, and it's the seventh leading cause of death across the globe. Let's talk to Professor Charles Marshall, who led the research at Queen Mary University of London. Welcome to the programme. So just take us through what you found.
Good morning. So we know that when people develop problems with their memory and go and see their doctor and get a diagnosis of dementia, their brain has been changing for 10 to 20 years by that time. And at the moment, we tend to rely on either seeing that somebody's not doing very well on memory tests or showing that their brain has shrunk on a brain scan to help us make the diagnosis. But before those things are evident, the way that the different regions of the brain talk to each other starts to be affected by the loss of brain cells in dementia. And that's what we were able to show in this study. So we looked at functional brain scans. So that's when somebody's lying in a brain scanner and the MRI scan is able to pick up how active different regions of the brain are. And we can use that to show how strongly connected the brain regions are. And we were able to show that the strength of connections between brain regions could predict who was going to get dementia up to 9 years in the future.
Yeah. So how does it help knowing something like this in advance, or at least having a pretty good idea, 80% certainty?
What we would really like to do is to find treatments that we can give people that can prevent them from losing brain cells and prevent them from developing dementia. Because once people lose brain cells, we can't replace them. And so we would like to be able to treat the condition as early as possible, ideally even before people get symptoms. So what I hope is that this might allow us to have a better way of finding people who are at risk of developing dementia to go into trials of treatment so that we can find those things that are going to change the situation that we have at the moment where there is no effective treatment available to people.
So am I right to think that at the stage where your new method is able to pick up the changes, damage has been already done, even if dementia itself is not fully developed?
We are seeing some signs of damage, but what we're seeing is changes in the way nerve cells are talking to each other rather than waiting until somebody's lost so many nerve cells that we can see on a brain scan that their brain has shrunk.
Got it. Okay, that makes sense. This then requires quite expensive technology, an MRI scanner, that sort of thing. It's not something perhaps readily available all around the world.
No, that's right. It does require an MRI scanner, but it could be done on any MRI scanner. So certainly here in the UK, an MRI scan tends to be a standard part of the process for getting a dementia diagnosis at the moment. And a typical MRI scan that someone would have if they were going to a memory clinic would take about 30 to 40 minutes. And this part is about 6 minutes of additional MRI scanning. So not hugely infeasible to build this into diagnostic pathways if we were able to show with more research that it would be helpful in that setting.
So that's the key then, is it? A bit more research before it gets rolled out in hospitals, certainly in this country.
Yes, exactly. We need to show that it continues to perform as well as it looks like it did in other sets of brain scans from other sources. And then we also need to explore how useful it might be as an aid to diagnosis as well as a prediction of dementia in the future.
And I suppose for people like you who work on this sort of topic on dementia and all its rather horrible effects, this is a pretty exciting moment.
We're very excited. We know that, you know, we would like to dream of a future where we can do things to protect people's brains from dementia, and we need to identify who the right people are to give those sorts of treatments to. And so this sort of thing could be the first step on the road towards being able to do that.
Professor Charles Marshall from Queen Mary University of London, thank you very much indeed. Just wanted to read you some of your reactions to our top story today on Sudan and the conflict there and the impact it is having on Sudanese. Alfred from the United States has written in to say, how long will the Sudanese people keep suffering and the world sit aside and watch? The toothless bulldog, the African Union, is only strong at talking but is weak in action. And just a few minutes' time, as Tuesday continues, we're going to hear from Anne Soy, one of our most senior correspondents on the country, on the continent, excuse me, of Africa, to talk about the conflict in Sudan. This is Newsday.
Distribution of the BBC World Service in the U.S. is made possible by American Public Media, producer and distributor of award-winning public radio content. APM, American Public Media. With support from Condor Airlines, offering non-stop service from 13 U.S. gateways to Frankfurt, Germany, plus seamless connections to over 100 European travel destinations at condor.com.
Support for KQED comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and their bedding at sleepworks.com. Real-time news, vibrant discussions. Follow KQED News on social media to join the conversation. Good evening, I'm Michael State. You're with the BBC World Service at 11:30.
Hello and welcome to Newsday from the BBC World Service with James Copnell and Victoria Wonghunda.
We're going to talk to our Deputy Africa Editor Anne Soy about the conflict in Sudan.
The Israeli Prime Minister will address the American Congress at the invitation of some Republicans.
And we'll bring you a report from Myanmar as the BBC finds evidence of torture and murder by the army there.
All that and more, but first, this news.
BBC News with Chris Berrow. President Zelensky of Ukraine is being welcomed as a guest of honour in France today following his visit to the D-Day anniversary commemorations in Normandy. He's due to address the French National Assembly in Paris before holding talks with President Macron. President Putin is to address Russia's flagship economic forum in St. Petersburg today. Western business leaders no longer flock to the annual event, but delegations are attending from Asia, Africa and the Middle East. Russia and China have announced a plan to develop the northern sea route through the Russian Arctic as a potential shorter alternative to traditional sea routes through the Suez Canal or around Africa. Melting sea ice has made the Arctic route viable. Voters in Ireland and the Czech Republic are voting for members of the European Parliament on the second of a marathon four-day election process on the continent. Donald Trump has made his first campaign appearance since his New York hush money case, apparently uncowed by his conviction. Addressing supporters in the key swing state of Arizona, Mr. Trump repeated his attack lines against President Biden on immigration. South Korea's biggest firm, Samsung Electronics, has been hit by its first ever strike. Members of a union representing almost 30,000 workers have taken a coordinated day of leave as part of their demands for better pay. Netflix says it intends to vigorously defend itself against a defamation lawsuit filed by a woman claiming to be the inspiration for the delusional and abusive stalker character in its hit series Baby Reindeer. The streaming giant said it stood by the show's creator, Richard Gadd. The Australian astronomer and TV presenter Greg Quick has died at the age of 62. Popularly known as Space Gandalf for his distinctive white beard, he rose to prominence on Australian TV and BBC stargazing programmes. BBC News.
Chris, thank you so much for that summary of news. Hello there and welcome to Newsday here on the BBC World Service with James and Vic. Now, all week here on the programme, we've been covering developing events in Sudan and shortly we'll be putting some of your questions to our Deputy Africa Editor, Anne Soy. And if you too want to take part, send yours to us here. Our usual number is +447 786 205085. We'll also go to Jerusalem and speak with our correspondent there, and we have a report from Myanmar about the cost of fighting the country's military rulers.
The UN says that at least 35 children were among the dead when the paramilitary group the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, attacked a village in Sudan to the south of the capital. As many as 200 people may have been killed in total in Wad al-Nura. The war between the RSF and the Sudanese military broke out in April last year and has brought the country to the verge of famine. We've been focusing on this issue all this week on Newsday. One expert told us as many as 4 million people could die. Another that it could be the worst famine to hit the country in four decades or more. We heard earlier today from the World Food Programme's regional director, who is equally pessimistic about Sudan's trajectory. So what sort of impact are food shortages and high prices having on people right now? Yesterday we heard from Mohamed El-Bilal, a co-founder of Khartoum Aid Kitchen, which feeds thousands of people in the Sudanese capital.
The situation of those trapped in Khartoum is a situation of famine, basically. So we find some terrible cases. And one of those cases is that of Sadiq. And Sadiq, he hasn't had a proper meal for over a month. And what it appears that's been happening is that any food that's been arriving, he's basically been prioritizing for his children. So I shared a picture of him and he's in a wheelchair, but he's not disabled. He's just so malnutritioned that he's lost the ability to walk.
Very, very shocking stuff. And you have been sending in lots of messages to us here on Newsday, raising your concerns and questions. Well, the BBC's Deputy Africa Editor Anne Soy joins us now on the line from Nairobi, having covered the conflict and followed what's happened in Sudan over the past year and beyond, of course. Dauda Kamara, Anne, sent us a message from The Gambia saying peace talks and a strong intervention by African Union peacekeepers need to happen. Are either of these things likely?
It's challenging. There have been several rounds of peace talks in Jeddah and elsewhere. There have been different efforts to try and bring the two sides together, but they haven't yielded much fruit. Lately, just last week, the U.S. Secretary of State had a phone call to the de facto president of Sudan, General Al-Burhan, and spoke about the need to go back to peace talks. And that is a request that Al-Burhan said he was not willing to take up, and had very strong words in response to that call for going back to those talks. Cairo has also invited the different parties to talk and invited civil society organizations as well. But then we have seen that the Sudan Armed Forces has made conditions for taking part in those talks and has listed the people they do not want to take part, including the regional body, the Intergovernmental Development Authority, IGAD, and including some of the civil society organizations. As you would know, James, there are civil society organizations that have come together. They have been meeting in Addis to try and find a solution for Sudan. But the army is opposed to that. So that is where that's where things are at the moment. There doesn't seem to be a clear way forward.
And on that issue of the need for African Union peacekeepers, we've heard other listeners talking about UN peacekeepers. There were, of course, peacekeepers in the country, in Darfur at least, before Joint African Union United Nations Force for many, many years, but that left a few years ago. I suppose without a peace deal, we're unlikely to see peacekeepers.
That's right. And that hasn't really been at the forefront of discussions at the moment. The priority has been to try and find a ceasefire and to try and bring the two sides together. But there's been a lot of unwillingness, especially from the side of the army.
So we had a message in the last minute or two from B.W. Bokeri in Freetown, Sierra Leone, who says the charge of genocide against the warlords is long overdue. Until regional bodies, including the United Nations, are totally involved in prosecuting those who carry the greatest responsibility for what's happening, I'm afraid that the future of Sudanese, impoverished and weaponless Sudanese, will remain bleak. So the question there, I suppose, is about the idea of charges, prosecutions, legal action against those deemed responsible for atrocities in this conflict?
There have been some very early efforts to try and find justice for the people of Sudan. The prosecutor of the International Criminal Court has been to Chad, where he carried out investigations. He briefed the UN Security Council, and he talked about, you know, how dire the situation there was. He had spoken to some of the victims of rape, some of the victims of the war itself. However, it's important to note that Sudan is not a signatory of the International Criminal Court. However, there have been indictments against leaders previously relating to previous conflicts. But then we saw very little movement on that. You would remember that there was an arrest warrant against the former president, al-Bashir, which was never executed. So it is complicated. It tends to take a long time, but there are movements in that direction. There have been sanctions issued by the United States against parties on both sides of the war. So in terms of trying to find justice for Sudanese, there is something that is happening, but it tends to take a long time.
And meanwhile, the fighting continues. Meanwhile, the threat of famine, the reality of famine, perhaps, as many Sudanese believe, continues. Wanted to give you a reminder of what it's like then to live in a war zone. We've been talking this week about fighting in Jazeera State, that devastating attack on Wad al-Nur village that might have killed up to 200 people. A listener sent in a strong personal testimony to our sister program OS. This is somebody who left Jazeera State a week ago because of the violence there.
مأساتي الشخصية مريرة جدا. أبناء عمومتي قتلوا. ديارنا نهبت.
My personal tragedy is very bitter. My cousins were killed in their homes. The women were raped and our money was looted. The rest of the family was assaulted and attacked. I was forcibly displaced. This is our situation for me and my family and the situations of the citizens of Al Jazeera in general. It is difficult to talk about my experience and the rest of the citizens of Al Jazeera. We experience the same suffering from the violations of the rapid support forces. We've heard of all the wars that happened in other countries, but the war and the violations from the rapid support militia makes my body shiver and are disgusting and unimaginable.
So that's then the impact on civilians. And Rex from Malawi says the world is giving attention to the wars in Gaza and Ukraine. Why is it that the war in Sudan is not getting the same level of attention?
That's a very good question, James. And, you know, it's a question that we have also been asking ourselves. You know, in terms of access, first of all, for us as journalists, it has been extremely difficult to get into Sudan to tell these stories, to talk to people, and therefore we rely on witness testimonies like the one that you have just played there, people who have come out, people who we are able to get in touch with. And I should say that connectivity has also been a huge, huge challenge, just getting those stories out of Sudan, because they're really desperate stories. They need to be told, and we continue to do our best, as you have been doing on Newsday throughout this week, to tell these stories to the world.
And sorry, our Deputy Africa Editor, live from Nairobi. Thank you very much indeed.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been invited to address a joint session of the U.S. Congress in Washington. The invitation is the initiative of Republican leaders and is scheduled to take place on July the 24th. However, many Democratic Congress members have indicated that they would boycott such an event. Well, let's bring in our correspondent in Jerusalem, Yolande Nell. Yolande, there seems to be kind of a divide between the two political sides in Congress. But both of them have actually agreed this is a joint invite. I wonder then, with the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democratic leader, supporting the invitation, but some of the Democrats are saying we are not coming. Does that show how divided the Democrats are when it comes to Mr. Netanyahu?
Indeed it does. And I think, you know, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer took some time to approve this invitation that was proposed by the House Speaker Mike Johnson a few weeks ago. And Chuck Schumer himself, who is a leading Jewish member of Congress, gave a speech on the Senate floor in March, and he called for early elections in Israel to replace Mr. Netanyahu. He's sort of ultimately, in this case, acquiesced, saying he's prepared to cooperate in an address by Mr. Netanyahu, as long as it's done in this bipartisan matter. But while Mr. Netanyahu is looking here to make his case for Israel's war in Gaza on a global stage, there is expected to be political fallout in America, really exposing those democratic divisions over Israel. The last time Mr. Netanyahu spoke to a joint session of Congress was back in 2014, and that was organized by Republican congressional leaders kind of behind the back of then President Barack Obama, and he used it to lobby against a nuclear deal that Washington was working on signing with Iran that year. We're expecting now an even bigger number of Democrats. Back then it was, I think, nearly 60 that boycotted that address. We're expecting an even bigger number to boycott a new speech as the war in Gaza has become increasingly unpopular among some sections of the Democratic Party.
How significant will that event be? Yolande?
How significant is that event would be?
Hello, Yolande, can you hear me?
There's some difficulties with the line. But, yes, it'll be an event that everybody is watching. We'd actually expected Mr. Netanyahu to speak more quickly to the joint session of Congress. We'd expected that to happen maybe even as soon as next week. But there's a Jewish holiday then, so he didn't accept. Now it's put back until July the 24th. So it's something, a lot could change in that time. Of course, the U.S., along with Qatari and Egyptian mediators, have been resuming talks this week aimed at securing a new truce and hostage prisoner swap for this war that's now been going on for 8 months. It could be a different situation we're looking at in late July, but I'm sure everybody is going to be listening to what Mr. Netanyahu says for clues on what happens next and what this could mean for American politics too. It's become a big issue in the presidential election campaign.
Absolutely. Well, everybody's watching and waiting to hear what Mr. Netanyahu will say when he addresses the Congress. Will also be following it up here on the BBC World Service. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Yolande Nell.
Talking all throughout the week on Sudan, playing messages from Ahmed, our regular audio diarist, and Garang Matiang in neighbouring South Sudan, said, "I shed tears when I listened to the message shared this morning to the BBC by the Sudanese citizen in Omdurman. Our hearts are with all Sudanese people and beyond, those who are victims of the civil war there." Now, here on Newsday, let's turn to sports with Isaac Fanu.
So the French Open tennis comes to an end this weekend. We've got men's semi-final day on Friday. Carlos Alcaraz takes on Yannick Sinner, and afterwards Casper Ruud plays Alexander Zverev. Joining us on the programme is Newsday's very own sports reporter and tennis commentator, Rebecca Adams. Morning to you, Rebecca. Before we start, I want to start back with the women's final. Jasmine Paolini taking on the world number one Iga Swiatek. Swiatek has looked absolutely sensational throughout this tournament. The only person who's caused her any issues has been Naomi Osaka very early on in the tournament. Do you think that Paolini has any chance?
Well, she's at least playing well enough and with enough confidence, Isaac, to hopefully make it interesting. But like you say, Swiatek has been looking really good. She's world number one. She's a defending champion. And she's looking for a third French Open title in a row. She also made Coco Gauff, who's going to move up to world number two in the rankings on Monday, look really, really ordinary in their semi-final. And like you said, only Naomi Osaka has come close to beating her in this tournament. And there's certainly no shame in that because she herself is a four-time Grand Slam winner. But since that match, that scare against Osaka Swiatek, she's found another level. So it'll be a really tough one for Jasmine Paolini. She's not a youngster by any means. She's in her late 20s now. It's not like she's come from nowhere. But this is a very surprising run from her. It's the first time she's managed to get past the second round at the French Open. And she's made it all the way to the final. She's had a really breakthrough year with some big wins over top 20s. and she's now in the top 15. But will we see an upset? Very much doubt it, because Świątek is just too strong, especially on this surface.
Let's talk about the men's games today. We've got a couple of cracking matches, don't we?
Oh, we absolutely do, Isaac. Yeah, we will have a new champion on the men's side after last year's winner Novak Djokovic pulled out on Tuesday with an injury before his quarterfinal match against Casper Ruud. But there are no surprises with the names we see lining up in the semis later today. We've got three of the top four in the world, plus last year's beaten finalist Ruud in that last four. And in the first of the semis, this is going to be an absolute cracker. It's a match that's worthy of the final. We've got world number two Jannik Sinner taking on world number three Carlos Alcaraz. And these two are expected to be the dominant players in the men's game for years to come now, with the old guard of Federer and Nadal, and to a certain extent Djokovic, making way. In the second semi, well, that's a sense of deja vu, because it's a rematch of one of last year's semi-finals with Alexander Zverev. He's out for revenge against Casper Ruud, who beat him at this stage in the tournament last year. As for Zverev, well, he's been beaten in the semis for the last 3 years, and he'll really want to shake that off, but he is on an 11-match winning streak. He won a big title in Rome in the lead-up to this tournament, but he makes Grand Slam finals. He's yet to win one, so it's sort of a case of always a runner-up with Zverev. And in Casper Ruud, we've got a clay court specialist, and he's made two of the last two finals, so he knows what it takes to get there.
And in terms of Djokovic, you mentioned that he has been injured. He had surgery, didn't he?
Yeah, he pulled out on Tuesday ahead of that quarterfinal with a tear in his right meniscus. He's since had surgery. Like you said, it's gone well. Recovery time for him is estimated to be between 3 or 4 weeks, and that leaves a question mark, really, over his participation at Wimbledon. That starts at the start of July. And not only that, he's also in a race against time to be fit for the Olympics as well, happening later that month. And, of course, Djokovic will be really thinking about the Olympic Games, because that is the title that's missing from his collection. And he'll really want to be fit for that, because by the time the next Games rolls around, he'll be 41. But knee surgery, of course, it's a serious thing, and time really isn't on his side.
Yeah, time really is not on his side. Rebecca, appreciate you for joining us this morning. Rebecca Adams, our very own Newsday sports reporter and tennis commentator, joining us. Let me give you some quick other sports headlines. The Boston Celtics in the basketball were dominant in game one of the NBA Finals as they beat the Dallas Mavericks 107-89. And we saw arguably the biggest upset in cricket history, as the USA beat Pakistan in the T20 Cricket World Cup in a super over victory for them. More sport for you next week.
Next week, yeah. How's it coming? Thank you.
Now, the military junta in power in Myanmar is facing real challenge to its rule in several parts of the country. In the Chin state in the west of the country, armed ethnic resistant groups have managed to push the military out of several areas near the country's western border over the past 6 to 7 months. The BBC has now had rare access to the state and has seen evidence showing a Burmese army campaign of torture, abduction and murder aimed at stopping young protesters joining rebel fighters. The Myanmar military is yet to respond to BBC's questions about these allegations. Our correspondent Yogita Limai reports from western Myanmar with Sanjay Gangula and Aikriti Tapar. There is a warning that some might find their report distressing.
Hundreds of young recruits are marching in a big open field under the scorching sun. We're surrounded by lush green mountains. We're at Victoria Base, which is the main headquarters of the Chin National Army. It's one of the rebel military groups that's been fighting against Myanmar's military. This is in the Chin state, which is in the west of Myanmar. About two-thirds of these young recruits in front of me are men. A third of them are women. They've joined the Chin National Army 1.5 months ago. And over the past 6 months, this particular rebel group has made significant advances in this area. Our motherland, the land we love, they sing. We'll defend it with our blood and life. 3 years ago, Myanmar's fragile democracy was crushed by a coup. But now the military junta is facing an unprecedented challenge. People in many parts of the country are rising to fight against them. Like 19-year-old Tan Da Lin.
The first year after the coup wasn't too bad. But then the military began shelling our village. It destroyed our home. Troops entered our village, burnt houses and killed people. My uncle was cruelly shot dead.
Driving through mountainous terrain, through heavily wooded forests, I've come to the village of Haimul. One of the things you see is on both sides of the road, there are quite a few burnt out homes. Some where literally there are a couple of pillars, wooden pillars standing and no other structure left. There's another one here right in front of me, which is partially burnt down. It's a concrete home, and when you go inside it, it's just everywhere. You can see kind of charred walls. Pretty much nothing remains. Across Myanmar, allegations have been made by civil rights groups that tens of thousands of homes were torched by the junta. There was a steady battle between resistance groups and the military junta, and we're just about to speak to the commander. His name is Vala. Can you tell me what was your job before 2021, and why did you decide to join the People's Defense Forces then?
Before 2021, I'm driving truck. We don't want a dictatorship. We need a federal democracy government.
And how does your family feel about you being on a front line?
Sometimes they are so worried about me, but I must do this job. For my son, my family, for our people, for our country.
Most of the people from the village are living in a relief camp a few miles away. I've come to it now. Lots of temporary structures with tin sheets or woven bamboo sheets as walls and tin sheets as roofs. We're here on a Sunday and you can hear the sound of an ongoing church service. Most of the people here are Christians. Two teenagers from the village, 17-year-old Lal Nunpui and her 15-year-old brother Lal Ratmoya, were killed in horrific circumstances. People have told us that they were kidnapped by the Myanmar military. They were tortured. The girl was raped and their bodies were found in a jungle 2 days later. All of this happened in August 2022, while the fight to take control of Haimul was underway. In this relief camp, we've come to see their mother, 37-year-old Lal Thang Tluangi.
It's hard to think of what my children went through, but we will not be discouraged by their death. People in the coming generations too need freedom. It is a fight worth sacrificing one's life for. I'm very proud of them.
Just a few miles from Haimul, I've come to the village of Komoi. One of the people who was killed in Komoi was 22-year-old Wanlal Pekthara. He used to be in the Burmese police, but after the military coup in 2021, he defected. He joined the civil disobedience movement. In a restaurant she runs by the side of the road, we meet his mother, Helen Molly Kiang. My son was stabbed here and here, Molly says, pointing to her chest and back. He was brutally killed. Even his leg was cut, she weeps. I'm sitting in the yard of Komoi's primary school, which is being used as a temporary shelter. All around the yard, there are classrooms which have been converted into areas where the people who've been displaced because of the fighting can sleep, they can cook. One of the classrooms, and it's got grade 2 written on top of it, houses a family that came here just 2 weeks ago. They would drop bombs wherever they wanted. We were scared. My husband said, it cannot go on like this. We have a baby, so let's flee. The evening we left, a man died in our village. I've come to what used to be the base of the Myanmar military. It's a few miles from the western border of Myanmar, and it looks completely destroyed right now. In front of me, I can see a deep sort of pit, which used to be the barracks where the soldiers used to sleep. There's corrugated tin sheets lying all over it. I can see to the left of me what seem to be trenches dug into the ground.
The Myanmar military was pushed out of this base in November 2023 by the Chin National Army. And to the right of me, I can also see they've hoisted their flag there. It's a tricolor flag, red, white and blue, and it's got the picture of a hornbill in the middle. And this is one of the signs that Myanmar's rebel groups are making advances against the military. The closest military base is about 30 to 40 miles from here now.
Our correspondent Yugitali Mai reporting from Western Myanmar.
Getting lots of reactions in to our top story, the war in Sudan. Celestine Kujabi from The Gambia says, if the effort to broker peace in Sudan is genuine, the guns need to be silenced and an arms embargo put in place. Amara Alpha in Kailahun, Sierra Leone says, the senseless infighting in Sudan must stop. Where are the African Union and UN member states? The complacency towards the war in Sudan is too much. And Musa A. Bility from Liberia says, good morning, Newsday. Thanks for keeping us updated with what's happening, and he hardly misses an episode. Great to have your company, Musa. Musa also says, I feel very sorry for the people of Sudan. That's it from this edition of Newsday. From Vic, me and all the team, bye-bye.
Bye.
Support for KQED.